Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Rodenberg, Judge Riley, Judge Bradfold, the Honorable John R. Rodenberg presiding.
You may be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. The first matter on the calendar this morning is it Levine?
Yes.
Levine versus Bayview Loan Servicing. It looks like both counsel are here and ready to go. You'll each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. As you approach the podium, give us your name and the party you represent so that we have that for the recording. There's a little toggle switch beneath the podium if you want to adjust that. Appellant, whenever you're ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Drewes, D as in David, R-E-W-E-S, as in Sam. I'm here representing appellant Hannah Levine. Hannah Levine and her ex-husband filed for bankruptcy protection on January 30th of 2011. Following a May 4th, 2016 bankruptcy discharge, the bankruptcy court case was closed in July of 2016. Shortly after that, starting in August of 2016 and going for the next several months, as shown in the addendum pages 11 and 12, there was credit reporting that began that harmed Ms. Levine's credit report, indicating that she still owed amounts that had been discharged in the bankruptcy. In this lawsuit, in a lawsuit that was brought in state court, we sought to stop the false credit reporting and award damages under the FDCPA. The particular provision under the FDCPA was 15 U.S.C. 1692E. There, the federal statute says, a debt collector may not use any false, deceptive, or misleading misrepresentation or means in connection with the collection of any debt. Without limiting the general application of the foregoing, the following conduct is a violation of this section. Subdivision 2, the false representation of the character, amount, or legal status of any debt. And subdivision 8, communicating or threatening to communicate to any person credit information which is known or which should be known to be false. The key to the case is that after discharge happens, she doesn't have personal liability to the debt. Because of that, the continued credit reporting after the discharge, after the case was even closed, was a violation of the FDCPA.
Of course, those are her claims.
Those are her claims. So the question becomes, well, is this the proper form? Should we be in state court? This is a federal statute. Why are we here? The FDCPA section that provides a private right of action under these subdivisions is 15 U.S.C. 1692K, and that says that actions on the FDCPA may be brought in any appropriate United States district court without regard to the amount in controversy or in any other court of competent jurisdiction.
Is there any authority for the notion that the bankruptcy court would be a court of competent jurisdiction?
That's actually unknown. So we cite the section, the bankruptcy code section 11 U.S.C. Section 105. This talks about how bankruptcy courts are a court of limited jurisdiction. It focuses on how the bankruptcy court is allowed to handle core proceedings, matters that are core to the bankruptcy action in itself. There's no question that Levine could go and bring a separate alternative claim, like a claim for contempt of court.
For a willful violation of the stay or something
like
that.
Yes, for a violation of this post-discharge injunction. But the question of whether or not she can bring an FDCPA suit in that case is unknown. We would have to go and argue in front of that court that we're allowed to, and we don't even know if we would succeed on that motion.
So, counsel, you've described your claim, Ms. Levine's claim, as the continued credit reporting.
Yes.
So is there a case, federal or state, that recognizes that claim as a viable claim under the FDCPA?
Yes, there is. I believe you'd have to go back to the original back and forth motion papers leading
up to the citation. You don't remember it off the top of your head, which I totally understand. And that sort of underscores my next question. That's not an issue that was decided by the district court in this case.
That's right. That's not an issue that was decided. In the underlying case law, there's arguments about how, reporting on a credit report is another quiver or another arrow in the quiver of the debt collector to try to compel someone to pay their debt. In If you look at the court's actual order, at least at the first part of the order, addendum page 2, the paragraph 7, the judge actually does rule that defendant began its collection efforts on the mortgage loan by reporting the pre-petition discharge debt with a balance. So in the factual background of the court's opinion, the court actually recognizes that the debt's discharged. Now this conflicts, you know, a page or two pages later when the judge is now saying, well, essentially waffling, saying, I don't know if this is discharged or not. And at that point is when the judge focuses on this matters more appropriately before the United States Bankruptcy Court. On that point, on the district court judge's ability to actually analyze whether the discharge actually discharged this debt or not, I'd point the court to the actual discharge order itself, addendum page 9. I don't think, you know, even pointing out the discharge of Chapter 13 debtors order almost suggests we need to interpret this order. But the language of this order is extremely boilerplate, especially the discharge paragraph, where number one, discharge, the debtors in the above case are discharged from all debts dischargeable under 11 U.S.C. 1328A. So this becomes solely a matter of statutory interpretation, not an interpretation of this order, per se, because the judge is saying anything under that statute that can be discharged is discharged. So really, it defers to the district court having to look at 1328A and seeing, okay, is this a dischargeable debt or not? That's statutory interpretation, and the district court has the ability to, you know, read the statute, analyze it, and make a determination on whether or not the debt's been discharged. And that was not, you know, essentially the district court punted and did not specifically address that. Instead, the district court just decided that that it would not entertain or finally make a determination on those points. Bayview, in its reply, in its responsive brief in this appeal, at the last sentence of page 1 and then going on to page 2 of their argument, acknowledges first that Minnesota District Court is clearly, or clearly is, a court of competent jurisdiction. So there's no argument about competency of the jurisdiction. Second, they acknowledge that this is not a forum nonconvenience case. I started to analyze that in my principal brief because, you know, that's, I guess, where I jumped when I read the court's opinion. The court's opinion doesn't actually tell us what the basis is for why, for actually dismissing the case without prejudice. It just says it's not appropriate. So I jumped to forum nonconvenience. If we're agreed that it's not, then Bayview brings up three possible reasons why the district court would be able to dismiss. One, federal abstention now applied to state law. So this is interesting because it's kind of the opposite of federal abstention doctrine, asking the court to create or allow this new idea that a state court can now defer to a federal court. In the cases it cites, there's always a pending alternative forum.
That's why I asked my initial question, is it's not at all clear to me that there is an alternative forum for the FDCPA claim in the bankruptcy court.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly one of my arguments.
Counsel, do you have any concern about statute of limitations for your FDCPA claim?
Yes, Your Honor, that is in the background here. That's not being argued, but there's a one-year statute of limitations from the violation. So going forward, this being dismissed without prejudice, now I'm going to bankruptcy court and I'm going to be arguing if you know, we lose here, then potentially I have to go to bankruptcy court. I have to argue, you know, can we please bring this claim? And then secondly, I have to say, and by the way, we're timely because this preceding action, this action, has all told those
right. Proceedings. Is there any case law that supports that tolling argument?
And I don't know.
Okay. And again, and I just want to underscore, I'm obviously asking things that weren't decided by the district court, and I appreciate that. But is that your understanding as well?
Yes.
The district court did not consider or decide any tolling or statute of limitations.
Yes, Your Honor. And I mean, even though it wasn't in the brief, Your Honor picks up on a key issue there. There's a concern about whether or not we can even bring the claim after the time has passed. If it's not federal abstention, there's arguments about comity and deference. All of the arguments of Bayview really focus in on cases in which there's a parallel litigation. As we just talked about, there is no parallel litigation pending. you know, I think it's an important factual note that the violations we complain of even occurred after the case was actually closed. The case, the bankruptcy case, closes before any of these things happen. So really to say that there's an alternative forum is anachronistic.
That's the order that's on page 9 of your addendum is the last thing in the bankruptcy file, right?
There's a copy that I, that is one of the last things. I can't say for certain it is the last thing.
But there were no more orders or proceedings after that discharge?
Sometimes after a discharge like that, there's like a final trustee report that explains where all the funds went or an order discharging the trustee from the case. A copy of the docket of that case is actually included. It is not in the addendum, but it is part...
It's in the record somewhere?
Yes. The declaration of Gregory Kelly, dated September 15, 2017, Exhibit A, is the docket that shows all the events of the case, including...
What was the date of it?
All filings. The September 15, 2017 is the date of the declaration. I want to make sure there's no confusion about what's actually being sought here. We talked about this a moment ago. I think Your Honor picked up on it clearly that we're not actually seeking enforcement of the order, or we're not seeking an action on the discharge injunction. Our case has a big block quote in it. I know block quotes can be annoying, but that was a United States District Court that was analyzing, okay, why does someone pick a discharge injunction or why does someone seek contempt of court versus an FDCPA, and really helps to distinguish the two ideas. And then the third point I'd like to point out was that, was what the court already raised, which is that, you know, we still don't even know whether or not we could bring that FDCPA case within the bankruptcy court. Ultimately, Randall v. Paul, which was a court of appeals opinion from this court from 2017, states that a plaintiff may sue a debt collector for FDCPA violations in federal or state court and recover actual damages, statutory damages, attorney fees, and costs. That's Randall v. Paul saying that we can do what we tried to do. We're asking to be able to go back to district court and complete that process. Unless there's other questions. Thank you.
It appears there are none. You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal if you wish to use that. Respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you. May it please the court. My name is John Westrick. I represent Bayview. I think the first thing I want to point out to the court is to answer your question, Judge Rodenberg. If you look at the cases in footnote 2 of my brief, they talk about that the bankruptcy courts can hear FDCPA cases, but then some of them deny the remedy substantively. So if you look at, there's the Garfield v. Aquin, the Walls v. Wells Fargo, the Roman Perez cases. Those are cases where FDCPA cases are brought based on a violation of the discharge injunction. And while they're heard in the court, there's a substantive reason, at least for some of them, as to why they cannot. The Randolph case, which is a Seventh Circuit case, rejects the notion and says, of course, you can bring an FDCPA case. So those are cases.
Footnote one in your brief.
Pardon?
Is that right? Footnote one.
Footnote one. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I said.
Yeah, I just want to make sure.
Footnote two.
Okay, thank you.
And so that's there.
Well, but those cases really are talking about when the FDCPA claim is also a violation of the injunction, right?
Well, but if you look at the lower court pleadings, you're going to see that the violation of the discharge injunction is a part of this case because of their reliance on the Rogers decision. And that's what Rogers is all about, is there a discharge? I mean, there's no question there's a discharge.
Right.
The question is, it's a Chapter 13 discharge, not a Chapter 7 discharge. So certain things aren't discharged, which is including...
Right, that's because of Paragraph 5 of the other document.
Right, or you have the 11 U.S.C., the 1322B thing, which says if it's a loan that's on your personal residence, it's not discharged if there's payments still being made. So... With respect to there not being a pending action, the Supreme Court's case in Gavley says there doesn't have to be another action. It just has to be something to where maybe we shouldn't be doing this. And I thought the district court's order below was actually very precise in indicating in the memorandum that this is a kind of a...
So, counsel, I think you're certainly right that some of the analysis that's been offered by the plaintiff focuses on whether there's a parallel or other pending action. But a lot of it also focuses just on an alternative forum, which, of course, your comments about the bankruptcy court having jurisdiction over both a contempt claim as well as perhaps an FDCPA claim have some relevance. But what about statute of limitations concern?
Well, usually what happens, if someone brings, as I did, a motion to say we're in the wrong place and you should abstain, I'm going to be stopped from claiming the statute of limitations when he goes back, because I don't get to say you shouldn't be here on a matter of discretion, as opposed to there was some legal impediment that said I can't be here. And just to be clear, counsel is right, and I've said this in the brief, the district court below had subject matter jurisdiction to hear this case. That is not contested. It's a question as to whether or not the district court abused its discretion in declining to exercise jurisdiction, because we have this interesting and very unresolved and unsettled issue of bankruptcy law that's going to be, as I said, is the fulcrum of this claim.
And I think a minute ago I heard you use the term abstention.
Yes.
Right? So is that the doctrine that you would peg? Let me finish my question. So is that the doctrine that you suggest we look at in terms of our analysis of whether the district court abused its discretion?
Abstention or comedy.
Okay.
Either one.
So let's start with abstention. Is there a case in Minnesota in which we have recognized that a state district court of general jurisdiction can abstain from deciding a case based on the type of analysis that we have here?
Yes, the Gavley case.
Okay, so that's what you would rely on.
That is, and then it was suggested, I would say, in a forum nonconvenience case from the Minnesota Supreme Court.
But those are two pretty different doctrines.
They are, but it was, if you read the Florence case, it suggests that one might not exercise jurisdiction if you're going to be interpreting new issues of law or where things are confusing. They are different doctrines. There's no question.
And I think you struggle a lot if we were to, first of all, our district court judge in this case didn't look at all the factors involved in forum nonconvenience, and I don't see you raising it in your brief. So
no, because
so
it's
drawing
not
the analogy to the case law isn't all that helpful.
This is not a forum nonconvenience case.
There's
I can't remember the case that I cited, but this is not. There's also a couple. There's a couple other cases. I think the Hand case was an abstention case, Your Honor, and. So it's either comedy or abstention, and they're really kind of the same doctrine, but they're different hats as I've looked at the cases. But we think that given that this would be writing on a blank slate for bankruptcy law in not only Minnesota but the Eighth Circuit, that sending this to the bankruptcy court is the right place to go, because otherwise we're going to have a state district court interpreting bankruptcy law that no one has interpreted. The opinions are sixes and sevens all over the country, and it is somewhat a confusing area of law, and there is case law that says if a state court makes a decision wrong on some bankruptcy issues, it's not enforceable. And so again, I think that the district court properly exercised its jurisdiction to say this should go to the bankruptcy court.
Was there actually a motion? Did you move for that relief, or did you just answer in response to their motion for summary judgment?
I answered, and I believe, and I don't have it in front of me, that I'd requested some kind of stay while we went off to the bankruptcy court and tried. But I did raise the problems that the court's going to
No doubt you argued the issue, but yeah. I didn't see a motion.
No, I didn't. I just responded.
Summary judgment or a motion to defer or a motion for anything.
No, I responded to their motion.
It seems like your principal argument was we haven't completed discovery, and so we shouldn't give them partial summary judgment yet.
I did argue that, but the court wasn't.
I understand, but that's sort of
terribly
the first
impressed
thing,
with that argument.
But that's the first thing you argued. Wait a
that
minute,
is.
It's too early for a motion for summary judgment here.
Correct. And then The counter motion, of course, was, well, given the Rogers case, it's an issue of law, and we don't really need to have any more discovery. And so, you know, and then we responded with, well, that's great, but Rogers is, in my opinion, of questionable precedential value, given it's not even followed in its own district. And so and there's a lot of other cases that have not followed Rogers. Some were pre, some were post. Again, this is a very archaic's not the word I'm trying to think of the arcane. This is a very arcane issue of bankruptcy law, and we think the bankruptcy court should rule on it in the first instance, that that's the right place to go.
But you didn't make a motion for that relief.
No, but we argued in it to the district court, and the district court did it. I think that usually the decision to abstain very well may be a district court decision that doesn't require a motion because, you know, we talked for a second ago about in a forum nonconvenience, you weigh the parties' things because a party requests it. But the notion of abstention or comity deference, that's really one court saying, I'm going to give deference or comity to another court. And so it's not necessarily the same that a party would ask to do it. It's more a court saying, as an instance of, for lack of a better word, professional judicial courtesy, this is something that I'm going to do.
But you would agree that abstention is a really narrow exception to a district for a district court's duty, really, and to decide cases that it has jurisdiction over.
Absolutely, and just as a great way to set this aside, had there been an Eighth Circuit case that decided this issue that we're talking about with this, then I think an abstention would have been improper because the district court below could have said, in Minnesota, when there's a conflict of the circuits, we follow the Eighth Circuit's decision. Here's an Eighth Circuit decision. I can follow it. I'm not writing on the blank slate and going down. And so I think that had there been law on this issue, even in the district court of Minnesota or the bankruptcy court of Minnesota, the lower court could have and probably should have exercised jurisdiction, but because there's not, I believe it properly exercised its discretion, and it could have gone either way. I mean, sometimes this court will say things like, we might not have done this, but that's not the issue. The issue is, was the court so wrong when it did it that it shouldn't have been allowed to?
With regard to the Gavely case that you do hang your hat on, that was a case where the court deferred jurisdiction to a tribal court in light of issues concerning tribal sovereignty, and where the United States Supreme Court precedent prohibits courts from infringing on the rights of, and I'm quoting, rights of Indians to govern themselves. I just see that case as really different than the facts in this case.
Well, in Gavely, there was no pending tribal court action. That's the first thing. There was no pending action, and the court said we're going to do this. The Gavely case court also noted that some of the issues that were before the court there were, in fact, issues that the state court had jurisdiction of. But I would also note that just as the federal constitution warns state courts not to exercise jurisdiction in tribal matters, the federal constitution also bestows bankruptcy jurisdiction on the federal court, on the Congress and the federal courts, and not on the state courts.
Well, but the FDCPA expressly says that FDCPA actions can be brought in state district court.
Absolutely, but this isn't just an FDCPA case.
They're not making a claim of a willful violation of a stay. They're making a claim of a violation under the Fair Debt Collection Practices
Act.
Well,
what they're making is a claim of the violation of the discharge injunction. The stay disappears with a discharge. So the discharge injunction is what says you have, one, you have been discharged, and two, there can be no attempts to collect on this debt. All right, that's how the discharge injunction works. So they are, in fact, making a claim that there is a violation of the discharge injunction. And while, because we didn't address it, counsel, when he started, he talked about the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and that if you look in my memoranda below, you will see there is federal case law precedent that says when someone, and counsel and I have talked about this, we disagree, but that says you can't bring that fair credit. It's appropriate to report a mortgage after a discharge on a credit report. Now, whether that's going to be the law in the Eighth Circuit or not, I have no idea, but there is...
We never got to that question here.
I know that, but because counsel raised it there, I just want to point out that the fulcrum, the principal issue here, as argued below, it's a little different argument now, but as argued below, was the Rogers case. And the Rogers case was whether or not this was a violation of the discharge. And that if it's a violation of the discharge, I believe the bankruptcy court should hear this in the first instance. And again, I am perfectly comfortable representing to the court, and if the court affirms, including it in its order, that we cannot assert the statute of limitations if we go to the bankruptcy court, because that was meant that would be totally unfair for us to take advantage of that way. So, again, our view is the district court properly exercised its discretion. Are there any more questions from the court? Thank you. I'll yield the rest of my time then.
Thank you. Appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that time.
I think the court is touching so many issues that I think are important, so I won't say much. There was a comment just a moment ago about the FCRA versus FDCPA. We've only made FDCPA claims, not FCRA claims. The FCRA is Fair Credit Reporting Act. We've brought claims under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. I think one of the big picture ideas is the question of, all right, this is a blank slate of law, as what counsel just said, and should the district court in Hennepin County really be opining on what a statute means in related to bankruptcy? Well, I think that's what judges do. I think judges make decisions based on reading the law, interpreting it, and putting it into place. And I think that if we start saying, well, we need the Eighth Circuit to make a decision before we can handle this sort of a case, then that suddenly is creating a major carve-out saying, okay, you can bring FDCPA cases, but not if there's anything controversial associated with federal law or other areas of law or other states or other statutes. Unless the court has other questions.
Am I correct in understanding there was no motion to dismiss by the respondent?
Correct, Your Honor.
It was your motion for partial summary judgment, and then in the course of discussing all that, this question came up, and then the district court did what it did.
Yes, that's my understanding, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, you got judgment.
Sorry?
You got judgment.
Yeah. The wrong way. Yes.
That's not what you're yes. asking okay. for.
Yes. All right. Thank you so much.
Further, it appears nothing. Matter is submitted. We'll issue our decision within 90 days. We thank counsel for your briefing and argument.